America may be reconsidering its war on drugs. While federal laws against marijuana remain in place, two states have decriminalized its use, and several, including Illinois, have passed laws allowing medicinal marijuana. Meanwhile, the death of actor Philip Seymour Hoffman from a heroin overdose has focused attention on the debate over whether heroin use should be handled as a criminal or a public health issue. I'm Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, I'm bringing you a 2013 interview with filmmaker Eugene Gorecki, who argued against current U.S. drug policies in his award-winning documentary, The House I Live In. Focus continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. The phrase war on drugs came from the Nixon administration, dating back to 1971, when it launched a campaign to fight the illegal drug trade. The initial proposals included rehabilitation for drug addicts and efforts to prevent people from starting on drugs. But over the years, the nation's drug policy has been known for the prosecution of drug traders and drug users. That policy may be slowly changing. The Obama administration doesn't use the term war on drugs, calling it counterproductive. Several states have relaxed their laws against one drug, marijuana, allowing its medicinal use. And in Colorado and Washington, its recreational use as well. And while federal drug laws remain largely unchanged, current White House drug czar Gil Kerlikowske has pointed to Sweden's approach to drug use, one that seeks to balance public health concerns with opposition to legalization. That's an approach Eugene Gorecki would find promising. Gorecki has made a string of provocative documentaries, including The House I Live in which he made the argument that U.S. drug policies did more harm than good and that there was a better way to approach the problem. The House I Live In won a Grand Jury Award for Documentary at the Sundance Film Festival in 2012. I spoke with Eugene Gorecki in April of last year. Eugene Gorecki, welcome to Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Eugene, I was wondering, The House I Live In covers a lot of ground on the issue of the nation's war on drugs. It talks to everybody from prisoners to politicians. But it also includes a very personal thread, a woman you considered practically part of your family growing up. Could you tell us more about her?
Sure. Her name is Nannie Jetter. Nannie was born in, that's her birth name. She was born in Crewe, Virginia, and like many black Americans, migrated north to find kind of a better life. And part of that better life she found, I think she would say, was coming to work for my family as a housekeeper. I was a child who, as a white American growing up, I had a sort of very natural set of sensitivities toward the struggle of black America because I came out of a Jewish household and there was a strong sensitivity among the Jewish community at that time toward black Americans as kind of as brothers in struggle. And I knew a lot of folks who were growing up alongside me in the black community, and many of them were young people in Nannie's family, whose family was very close to my own. So in many ways, I got to start to see something that was happening to black America through Nannie's family and others that had to do with sort of the obstacle to black progress. You know, we thought with the Civil Rights Movement having just passed, I was a kid, but the romance of my childhood was that I was growing up at a time where finally black Americans were going to kind of come into their own and see the promises of America fulfilled for them after so many dreams deferred. And instead, you know, I grew up and I could see that the young people around me, they were not encountering the kind of opportunity I was. They were encountering obstacle after obstacle. And that really started to become clear to me through Nannie's own struggle as a matriarch, trying to keep it together with a family that was really almost under siege.
Now, were you aware of this when it was going on, when Nannie was working for your family?
I was a pretty precocious kid, and the most precocious part of me was aware of this. So at age 5, age 6, I was already a kid who had very strong, my heroes were all not only black Americans, they were black Americans of great note for their political courage. I was, you know, my number one idol was Muhammad Ali, and where other kids might have been very infatuated with Ali's boxing, I was pointedly aware that Ali had resisted the draft. I remember as young as sort of 7 or 8 years old that it was a big deal for me that Ali had stood by his beliefs in that way and given up the prime of his fighting career for something he believed. So those kind of heroes dominated my childhood landscape, and So yeah, there was some sensitivity. Of course, it took into my teens to really start to recognize that black people were encountering really a phenomenal obstacle, a societal obstacle or set of obstacles. And gradually, that's what led me on the journey that produced this film, which ultimately is a film about the war on drugs, because it became clear to me that the mass incarceration of black males in particular, which was shattering the black community from beneath, in a sense, it was sort of undermining it, that was really directly a product of the war on drugs.
Now, as part of your movie, The House I Live In, you meet with Nanny Jeter, and I don't know if it's been several years at that point since you had last had much contact.
No. That I don't want to give anyone the wrong impression. As I grew up and got older, after I went away to college, I came back to a world where Nanny had retired. And I wasn't really satisfied with the usual runnings of, you know, oh, yeah, she was my housekeeper, and, you know, once a year I'll send her a Christmas card. Nanny was somebody who was very formative to my thoughts and to my feelings growing up. She was a very instrumental friend to me, even though she was also a housekeeper. And we were always told as kids, people may get confused, her name is Nanny, so they think she's a nanny. She was never a nanny, and we make that very clear in the film. And I do, because I'm kind of under strict orders my whole life. We were always told, you know, that Mrs. Jeter, as she was called, she's the housekeeper. She does not look after you kids, and you don't bother her. You don't get in her way. She's here to clean the house. She's not here to care for you guys. Now, the fact is, she gave us an enormous amount of care, but it was always at her, at her election to do so. But years later, I elected to go back and find her again, because in my early 20s, I kind of really needed that kind of wisdom in an ongoing way. And it's meant that our relationship has been extremely strong, really throughout the years. It led to this movie because many conversations we had kept breaking my heart about the way her life path had unfolded.
So, in a way, the main point of your movie, that there's something wrong about the way America has conducted its war on drugs. Did you reach that conclusion out of your continuing conversations with Nanny Jeter?
Yes, but like most Americans, she didn't even know much about the war on drugs. It's not she who said to me, my kids are suffering and the war on drugs is to blame. In fact, if you ask her, she'd say, my kids are suffering and drugs are to blame. And that's what many Americans think, and it's why many Americans were supportive of tough-on-crime drug policies, because they feel so angry at the ravaging of their lives and their loved ones by drugs that they'll, you know, let's do anything to stop this. The trouble is that as David Simon, the creator of The Wire, who appears in the film, as he points out, you know, whatever damage drugs haven't done, the war against them has. That drugs are an obvious social problem. They are a public health problem in America. They should never have been a criminal problem. Of course, we'll talk about that. But they're a public health problem. The war on drugs was the wrong way to handle a health problem. All you're doing when you attack people who are afflicted and you throw them in jail and deeply damage their lives is you deepen the conditions that led to their addiction. So you do nothing to treat them, which is why America has the toughest drug laws in the world, and we have the highest undeterred levels of demand. We've failed 100% to curb this. So that picture of the drug war doing more damage than the drugs themselves, that was not known to Nanny Jeter. That's something that I started to learn as I went around the country to 25 states to figure out whether her life experience was the exception or the rule. And what I found is that it was common across the country, this kind of experience of families standing by, feeling ravaged by drugs, not really doing the math and understanding the deeper, far more grievous, invisible enemy of the war on drugs and its machinery of destruction.
We're talking with Eugene Jarecki. He is the filmmaker behind The House I Live In, a documentary that makes the argument that America's war on drugs has taken the wrong turn on the problem. We'll welcome you to the conversation here on Focus. Email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. Take a call now from Belgium, Illinois, line 4. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning. I have discussed this problem with Mr. Inge, the previous host of this show, for about 20 years now. It seems almost hopeless what we've done. The problem with drugs is strictly the profitability in drugs. That's what causes the problems all the way along. If we would just put them in the pharmacies, prove that you're a habitué of it, license marijuana growth, tax marijuana growth and control it that way. That way we know who the people are, we know who controls it, we know the supply, we know the quality, and we get rid of this social tax that we have on ourselves. We send huge quantities of money to people who really are mistreating everybody. They're, you know, it's just a horrible situation. Why in the world we do not legalize drugs is beyond me. Thank you very much for my rant. Good day.
Thank you very much for calling. Can I
respond to that for a moment?
Yes, please.
You know, he raises this idea of legalization of drugs, and I'll tell you the following about it, because I've been in about 45 states this year, and I speak to a lot of audiences, as I did last night here in Sacramento, and yesterday I spoke in front of the California legislature here. Invariably, when people hear the idea of legalization, they get very scared of it, because it sounds like a kind of mysterious future where very hard drugs that can really damage human beings are suddenly just willy-nilly made legal, and everyone pictures it like Night of the Living Dead with people dealing drugs to your kids on every corner. I think that's a very dangerous misconception, and I think the word legalization has been so stigmatized by now that I myself don't use it. What I instead would say, and it's not just semantics, is that drugs are a public health matter of great seriousness. The government, in my view, after decades of doing it wrong, has an ongoing responsibility to have a smart, science-based, evidence-based regulatory role. And so I would prefer to use the language that the government should tax and regulate drugs. Yes, they should be decriminalized, as Portugal did a decade ago with stunning results. We should no longer have criminal penalties for the personal possession of drugs. But I think that we already learned from Prohibition that doing it this way is a disaster. And when we learned the lessons of Prohibition, what did we do? We entered a world that we've lived in with alcohol ever since, which is that the government taxes and regulates alcohol. It's a controlled substance. Children cannot be sold it. Grown-ups have to use it responsibly. And if you use it irresponsibly, if you drive your car and kill somebody with it, if it turns out you were drinking, that manslaughter is going to become murder. So we have a system in place for dealing with alcohol, which, as you may know, is a far more destructive drug to public health and public safety than any of the drugs on the schedule of illegal drugs in this country. So it's astonishing to me, first of all, that we treat those safer drugs than alcohol more severely. That's already violative of common sense. But the second thing is that the government has this absurd and costly role. The drug war has cost us $1 trillion over 40 years. We've had 45 million drug arrests, and we have nothing to show for it but a record of abject failure. Drugs are cheaper, purer, more available than ever before, and used by younger and younger people. So by any measure, it's failed to do it this way, and the right way to do it would be to legalize responsibly, and that is a tax and regulate system that deals with it like alcohol and takes the incredible savings you will have when you don't waste $1 trillion on criminal justice and spend even a fraction of it would make the most robust treatment system in the world, and America would be building lives rather than destroying them.
Well, let me go over some of the points and the arguments you make in the movie, the House I Live In. And first of all, have there been no gains over the years from prosecuting the use and trafficking of illegal drugs?
I somehow the line broke up and I didn't hear the last part of that question.
Have there been no gains over the years from prosecuting illegal drug use and trafficking?
If you talk to prosecutors, I had a recent conversation with a key prosecutor in the Northeast, and I said, this is what my arguments are about the war on drugs. What do you think of them? And they said, well, we largely agree. I mean, everybody agrees this thing has failed as a drug war. What I will say to you is one of the side effects of the drug laws is that, you know, we do use them to catch violent people, and that we think they are some part of why we've seen a drop in violence in certain areas in the country. And first of all, reasonable people can debate the person's position. It has some truth in it, and it has some points that there's strong debate about. But to take it, you know, to take it seriously, sure, okay, maybe that's true. So maybe what you're saying is you've taken drug laws and you've cast such a wide net with them that while netting hundreds of thousands of nonviolent people who should not be in jail and having their lives destroyed, you happen to have managed to catch a few bad apples in the mix. Sure, I mean, that's like going dynamite fishing. I mean, it's not a skilled way of fishing. It's not an evolved way of fishing. It's a, you know, it's a smart bomb way of fishing. You just come in and destroy everything. So or an atom bomb way. I mean, I think it argues against itself, even though it sounds like an argument for something. The reality is that we get violent people with drug laws the same way we got Al Capone for tax evasion may sound clever, but you ought to become better at law enforcement to get the violent for violence rather than casting a net that hits so many and happens to grab a few apples.
And in the meantime, a big argument in your film that a lot of other nonviolent people are being taken along the way.
Well, endless. I mean, America's explosion of the prison population, we have seen a growth of 700% since 1971 when the war on drugs was declared. That's directly a product of the drug war. Now, that explosion of prison population is also dominated by the nonviolent. So California, where I spoke in front of the legislature yesterday, is voting this morning on a bill that would revisit the sentences of juveniles who were given adult sentences if they have shown 10 years of good behavior. I believe they're going to vote for it. California already voted on Election Day to move away from the kind of excessive sentencing that's dominated the state and the country for decades. And all too often, what it does is put nonviolent people away as if they're violent. Until Election Day, you would go to jail for the rest of your life in California for a third strike that was as petty as stealing a slice of pizza. That would give you a life sentence. So we're hopefully moving back from the brink of such madness that has gripped the country for so long.
Your film, and I think the examples go back to the late 19th century, your film looks at a pattern of crafting drug laws to essentially target the minorities of the day, whatever minority was seen as some sort of social threat or challenge, rather than actually looking at dangerous drug use as a whole.
Yes, I mean, we've had drug laws in this country going back, it turns out, to the 1800s. I didn't know that before making the film, but the first laws we saw were opium laws that were used to target Chinese immigrants coming to America. Now, they were seen as a threat to jobs. Well, you couldn't pass a law saying it was illegal to be Chinese, but you could pass a law that said, we're going to take some practice that the Chinese do, and we're going to vilify that. And then we have reason to be able to stop, search, harass, detain, and even incarcerate these people. And that became the use of opium. But the interesting thing is that opium was widely used in America at that time. So they wanted to cast a very selective net. And so they didn't make opium illegal across the country. They only made it illegal in California, where the Chinese were coming. And they didn't make all uses of opium illegal. They just made the smoking of opium illegal, because other Americans used opium in a lot of other ways, but Chinese dominantly smoked it. You see that kind of selectivity as just sharpening the fine point of the racism of the law, because this law, like many that followed it, was just a thinly veiled law of racial control. The next time we saw such laws were in the punishment of Mexicans under the conversion of hemp, which was a very loved crop, into marijuana. Suddenly it was given a Spanish-sounding name so that we could identify the use of that substance, particularly with Mexicans, and give ourselves reason to stop, search, detain, and so forth, Mexican populations who were threatening jobs. We saw this with black Americans and cocaine in the turn of the 20th century, and then, of course, we see it in the modern era with the incredible targeting of the black community under crack laws, under laws that were passed to deal with the hysteria that arose around crack in the 1980s, much of which, I hate to say, was deeply mythological.
I want to play a clip from the film now, and this will be the first clip of two we have. And this is really setting up a description of how the House I Live In argues that the role drug trafficking plays in poor, isolated minority economies in slums and ghettos, essentially, where with nothing else to turn to, drug trafficking becomes the dominant economic engine. And am I describing that correctly?
Yeah, very, very well.
Well, in the clip we hear from Dennis Whidbey, who used to deal drugs himself, talking about the status of drug dealers in the inner city in New York City.
The drug dealers are looked at as really the leaders of the community. If your moms can't pay rent, they help out on the rent. If you need a little bit of food sometimes, they will give money to your household for food. It's like back in the days, Magic had the Converse out. Everybody wanted the new Converses, and he would get them for you. The drug dealer would come right up the block from us, five or six of us. You pick out a pair, you pick out a pair, you pick out a pair. We come back on the block, we all carrying sneaker boxes. He in front of us. Everybody running over to us. Oh, we get the magics, you get the magics, you got the magics. And then we would tell him where we got them from. The next step is every time he comes on the block, you always under him. He wants his water from the store. He give you a $5 bill. Go get me a water. You know the change is yours. Half these waters he didn't drink. Ice cream truck came, always bought us ice cream. And he didn't even have to pay. He'd tell the ice cream man, hey, yo, get him. And ice cream man give us all ice cream. Honestly, I loved them. I loved them because when they came around, it was Christmas. As you get older, they say you get your own money. Sell drugs. Sell drugs. I don't know how to sell no drugs. I say, he's like, you don't have to know how to sell them. Just stand there. I'll send them over to you. He gave me the drugs. I stood there, and he'll point, and they'll come to me. And I had my own sneaker money. I had my own movie money. And then I had my own power.
I had my own power. Now, is that a concept that that you heard from more than one person in working on this film?
Yeah, I mean, David Simon, again, who created The Wire, says it best in the film, where he says, you know, we stand by and we sort of scratch our heads why young people in inner cities or in forsaken rural communities turn to drugs. And there are so many reasons why the society is undermining them, not giving them guidance. Major infrastructure and health care and education are failing them. And at a young age, they dabble like anybody dabbles, and they get a little strike on their record because a cop picks them up because the cop is disproportionately targeting them as a poor person or as a minority person. They get picked up, and now they have a mark on their record that they can never erase, and it means that forever they have trouble getting jobs in the mainstream economy. So the drug economy becomes the only game in town. And to add to that, that in that broken environment, as Dennis Whidbey points out, the drug dealer is like Santa Claus. He comes along and gives your mother help. He gets you sneakers when you need them. Small things for him to do, but huge things for someone who's not getting that kind of support, guidance anywhere else. And when you talk to the major drug dealers, it's not just pernicious. There is a strange, you know how we always looked at like The Godfather and mafia shows, and we saw that even within organized crime, there are deep codes of honor, there's family, there's depth, there's love. All of that exists even at the edge of the world. You know, I'm sure the inmates at Guantanamo have within themselves deep bonds of fraternity and lots of other human emotions sitting within the madness of being trapped in an incarcerative purgatory like that. Well, the same is true in the world of the drug war with all of its power structures and its crime and everything else. When you don't have family elsewhere, you make family out of the tools you have in front of you, just as many of the prisoners I saw in America are in their family in the jail. So within that world, all the basic elements we all associate with ordinary living remain the case. There are father figures, mother figures. There's a basic way of making your living. There's risk and reward and growth and upward mobility. It's just a parallel universe that our intolerance as a society and our greed as a society has created. We've built this marginal other American space in which people have to find their way, and they do.
Tell me about the title of the movie, The House I Live In. How did you come up with that?
It's actually named after a Paul Robeson and Frank Sinatra song from the 1940s that asks a very pressing set of meaningful questions about America. The song begins, "What is America to me?" People can go on YouTube, by the way, and listen to John Legend's cover of the song, which he's cut for the film. We just released it yesterday. Just do The House I Live In Legend, and you'll see we've made an amazing music video about the prison system where you see images of prison life set against John Legend's extraordinary voice singing this very poignant song, "What is America to Me?" Is it a word? Is it a name, a flag I see? And what he comes to think in the song, Paul Robeson and now John Legend, is, well, it's the men who built this country. It's this idea of America as this melting pot of hardworking people from far climes around the world all coming together and enjoying the town square together and sharing those goals of a society. And when you listen to this very idealistic song set against the really bleak, heartbreaking realities of our system of mass incarceration in America, the extraordinary disproportion with which we've targeted our poor and incarcerated them, you really feel we've gone a great distance from what we truly believe in, and I think the country needs to go back to deeply held first principles in order to fix much of what ails America, but this is a very aggravated area.
Well, it's time for a short break, and we'll be back with more about the house I live in and America's war on drugs with Eugene Jarecki. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and you're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous program. We're back with Focus on WILL AM 580. I'm Jim Meadows, and you're listening to an encore edition of Focus. We're not taking live phone calls this hour, but we welcome your feedback on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus.
A house I live in, a plot of earth, a street, a grocer and a butcher, and the people that I meet, the children in the playground, the faces that I see, all races and religions, that's America.
And that's Frank Sinatra singing The House I Live In from a short film he made in 1945, in which, as I remember, he breaks up a fight among kids who are a fight, I think, on racial or ethnic divisions.
Yep.
And had you thought about that? Had you thought about that song and the message of that particular film in particular, you know, just as you were working on the movie?
Yes, because, you know, Sinatra made that song, and it had a lot to do, actually, with Jews coming to America fleeing the Holocaust, which my own father did in 1939. And that was in large measure what gave me a lot of the sensitivities I have to struggle for identity and dignity and rights and self-defense around the world for any group. And it's just amazing to think that we should see in our own society in America, even after the Civil Rights Movement, the conditions we've seen in recent decades, which Michelle Alexander in her remarkable book called The New Jim Crow, you know, is we've renewed Jim Crow with the drug war and with this runaway system of industrial mass incarceration. Now, you should understand that part of why it's called The House I Live In is that, you know, it's also about my own growing up. It's about looking at a country and realizing it's your own and that, you know, before you go criticizing other countries, you really need to get the affairs of your own place in order. And that's what I'm trying to do. I mean, I traveled to 25 states to film this movie and to really talk to people at all levels of a system that is preying upon people all around me. And I am not preyed on it. I'm a comfortable white American. This doesn't touch me barely at all. But Eugene Debs said it best, I think, when he said, while there is a soul in prison, I am not free. And our incarcerative addiction in America, to give it the correct word, I mean, we are more addicted to the business of incarcerating people than anyone is addicted to a substance in this country. And that is destroying the country in a way that I think is fundamental to our national soul. So a song like this, which reminds you of the better angels in our nature, the country we want to be, I think is the right positive way to think when you're trying to solve a quite negative problem.
Well, if you have calls or questions or comments for Eugene Jarecki, the maker of the documentary The House I Live In, email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have a caller right now. I want to say hello to Paul on line one from Champaign County. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Thanks. I wanted to thank you for your earlier book and film called Why We Fight as well.
Thank you.
The targeting of minorities, as you point, was very explicit, but in the Haldeman Diaries, there was another dimension, and it was to criminalize the sort of youth culture anti-Vietnam War left during the Nixon era, and that was explicitly discussed as well. I know there's not time for everything in the documentary, but I really think that's an important dimension to bring up. But one thing I'm just aghast at the stop and frisk marijuana stops that are happening in New York now. There's finally a legal aid lawsuit against it. It's so I didn't even know, it was kind of under the radar that New York decriminalized an ounce of pot, but you can't display it. And stop and frisk, they make you dump your pockets and then they bust you for for the pot that you were legally holding until they asked you to dump it.
Yeah, and it's exactly. You're pointing out a crucial thing that I think people need to know. When you get stopped on the street of New York, if you're carrying marijuana in your pocket, it's not a crime. It's a violation. Then, of course, what does the officer ask a young person who has no lawyer present, doesn't know anything about life? He asks them to do it, empty your pockets. So now the young person reaches into their pocket and takes what is in their pocket, which is not a crime, brings it out into the open air, converting it into a crime, at which point they're arrestable. So on the advice of a law enforcement officer, a young person manifests a crime. It's an extraordinary situation, but worse than the pernicious detail we just talked about is the fact of the statistics of stop and frisk. We stop 700,000 people on the streets of New York every year. 87% of them are young blacks and Latinos. Half of those lead to a frisk. So 350,000 frisks a year. Of those, only 10% lead to an arrest. In the remaining cases, it's just, in 90% of cases, it's just, oh, you can go now. Sorry. If there's even a sorry. Meanwhile, you've denigrated this young person in front of their community, their housing project, their school, their pastor, whomever. And then we turn to these young people and say, show some personal responsibility. Show some faith in the system. Believe in your teacher. Believe in your pastor. Believe in the social worker. When we are going to kneecap you, what turns out to be once every 45 seconds. It's disgraceful.
Paul, thank you very much for calling in. And we have another caller waiting right now. And let me go over to line two, Eleanor in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. This relates to solutions to this problem. I'm on a research team for a task force that's against jailing people here for this.
That's against what, ma'am?
Putting people in jail.
Okay.
For these offenses that they shouldn't be in jail for.
Excuse me, ma'am. Are you talking about the task force that the Champaign County Board set up a few months ago?
No. This is independent.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm going back to a meeting. I need an example of model programs in the United States that deal with the difficulties that these kids have in these neighborhoods they grow up in.
Yep.
And any other difficulties that any of these people have that are put in jail when they should be in mental health or drug rehab other than drug court. I'm looking for a model program, and I've had a hard time finding it.
Sure. I think there's a few things I would point you toward. One is I would recommend you go to our website, which is called The House I Live In, the title of the film, thehouseilivein.org.
Yeah. Okay.
If you go there, you can enter your zip code, and it will tell you in your state what the major issues are going on in the war on drugs and who's fighting on behalf of trying to reform those issues, which is very helpful because you get to see where mm-hmm. you can lend your own efforts, and you'll also see what programs are at work to try to go against mm-hmm. things in individual areas.
Okay.
There's also a group called Operation Ceasefire, run by David Kennedy of John Jay Criminal College of Justice. They actually focus on reducing gun violence in inner cities, but they do it through very collaborative programs between the police and clerics,
okay.
and schools and social workers. It's very smart and has been incredibly successful, not only at dropping violent crime, something like 60% in a place like Providence,
okay.
Rhode Island,
okay.
but also building fortified community relations between many of the relevant players here so that kids do get a better chance. So Operation Ceasefire, very valuable. And then finally, I would please steer people toward Congressman Bobby Scott's Youth Promise Act. As you may tell from my testimony, I'm not a big believer in Washington, Capitol Hill, or either of the two parties. But the Youth Promise Act is truly an act that, if were passed, would have a wonderful effect on the lives of American children.
Okay.
Because it diverts resources currently being wasted on the war on drugs and puts it into whatever PROMISE stands for, which is all about, you know, doing good things to children, education, things like that. PROMISE is one of those big Washington acronyms. But the Youth PROMISE Act, you can Google, and you'll get a sense of that and really try to pressure your own Congress people to vote for it.
Okay. What's Bob's last name?
Bobby Scott.
Okay, and could you repeat your website, The House I Live
yes,
In?
Ma'am. TheHouseILiveIn.org.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Good luck with what you're doing.
Thank you very much for calling. I do have to note that in the movie, The House I Live In, you spend most of the time making the arguments on the problem with the problems with the conduct of America's war on drugs. Towards the end, you talk about some efforts towards change for a hopeful note. You don't really get much into many specifics, not, for instance, like the specifics you gave just now. Was that a deliberate decision on the film, or did you just not know about some of these things when the film was being made?
I had a very specific view of that. I've made several films before that deal with large national tragic issues, situations that need repair, and there are always, thank goodness for them, major reformers working out there, armies of people who take it upon themselves to be Madison, to be Jefferson, to try to make a better country. I wanted to be very careful to tip my hat to that in the movie so that people know all is not lost. There's actually a tremendous amount of effort being expended by hardworking people to fight this, but there are many ways to go about reforming the drug war, and I was fearful that if I tried to get too much into them, the movie would become either too long or I would just do a very sort of ham-fisted, you know, short and convenient way of alluding to these things without giving them their due. They're hard to talk about because very often the drug war is so Byzantine that you're dealing with all these minutiae in the law and you get it becomes mind-numbing to even listen to it. So I also was pointedly aware that what I was making, and I hope I've made, is a tool for people who are seeking change all around the country, in state after state, city after city, region after region. And we're finding we've done hundreds, literally, of screenings this year in prisons, churches, schools, community centers, far from the usual theatrical crowd, which we also released the film theatrically, and it was on PBS last night and all that. We also do this bringing the mountain to Muhammad. We show the film in neighborhoods that need it, among activists who are trying to make change and move public opinion and even move their legislators. So what I did yesterday on the floor of the California Senate, which was to show the film and to talk to legislators, they're voting today on a bill that will affect 21,000 inmates who are sentenced as juveniles. That's the right use of a film like mine to raise public awareness and to remind people of the natural sensitivities in the better angels in our nature. That's what I think the film does by pointing out the problem. How people want to reform it, today's California reform technique is tomorrow's Chicago one. And I didn't want to make a film that threw my lot in with one or another at the exclusion of any other. Oh, that's a film about mandatory minimums, or that's a film about legalization, or that's a film about... Those are all things that different people can disagree about, but the film's problems, the diagnosis of how we got here, I think that's harder to argue about.
Let's go to another caller on line one, Eric from Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Yes. Would you comment on my belief that the pharmaceutical companies, with all their monetary influence, don't want marijuana legalized because that would interfere with their high-profit, multi-side effect drugs?
It's been talked about over the years. This goes back to an old claim about the Partnership for a Drug-Free America. I work rather closely with the partnership these days, but that's a change because over the years the partnership was one of the major engines for pushing the war on drugs to the severe extremes it got to. I think they've come under new leadership and come under sort of a they've done the great thing that so few Americans do of really changing their views in a healthy way and admitting to that. But I think there were times where the Partnership for Drug-Free America was accused, kind of conspiracy theory style, of being funded largely by Johnson & Johnson, and it was the idea that it was an organization that was trying to make sure that drugs were, it was almost like the Partnership for an America Free of Drugs that Johnson & Johnson doesn't provide you. And that idea goes back in time. Look, I think if I were a legitimate pharmaceutical maker, I could have both a defensible reason for wanting to be an enemy of marijuana, and I would have a corrupt reason. The defensible reason is we all believe, I don't, but I think the country has gone into this runaway profit-seeking is the most important thing in the world. Well, I don't agree with that, but I think a lot of people think, well, that's what America's about. I don't agree. But I think a place like Johnson & Johnson, a pharmaceutical giant, that's what they're supposed to do for their shareholders. Like, until we change the system and make it more equitable and more fair to people, that is what they're supposed to try to do. So the defensible part is, well, we want to push our drugs, and therefore we want to curry favor with the government, and we want the government's view to be that certain kinds of legitimate drugs, those are the ones for sale, and the illegitimate drugs are not. So that's the sort of standard business practice version. The more pernicious version is, if you now watch how the pharmaceutical companies have our children getting into things like Ritalin and all of these other drugs, I think, being given to children very experimentally. We give things to children in this country that are illegal in European countries. I think you're watching a society where the pharmaceutical industry is quite perniciously addicting people and becoming their pusher. And I think we're going to see over the next 10 years extraordinary darkness that lies in what the pharmaceutical companies know about the perils of what our children are getting introduced to.
Sir, and John Stossel on Fox, who's written a book, No, They Can't, says that the reason the legal system likes the illegality of drugs is that they can go in and seize all the money that a person has and say it's part of drug proceeds, which is obviously a leak in logic. His book, No, They Can't, talks about the falsity of the drug laws.
Yeah, Stossel does a lot of work to poke holes in a lot of American myths. He's a great, great contributor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. And let's play a second clip from The House I Live In. And this goes into how the war on drugs has affected police work across the country. And in this clip, we hear a detective in Baltimore talk about how law enforcement officers view drug crime.
The problem is that cop that made that cheap drug arrest, he's going to get paid. He's going to get the hours of overtime for taking the drugs down to ECU. He's going to get paid for processing the prisoner down at Central Booking. He's going to get paid for sitting back at his desk and writing the paperwork for a couple hours. And he's going to do that 40, 50, 60 times a month so that his base pay might end up being only half of what he's actually paid as a police officer. We're paying a guy for stats.
We can leave them here and then we can go back out and do this other deal.
Compare that guy to the one guy doing police work, solving a murder, a rape, a robbery, a burglary. If he gets lucky, he makes one arrest for the month. He gets one slip signed. And at the end of the month, when they look and they see, Officer A, he made 60 arrests. Officer B made one arrest. Who do you think they make the sergeant?
Okay, let's move in, guys, move in.
In a city like, say, Baltimore, where I'm from, our percentage of arrests for murder, for rape and robbery, are half of what they once were. Our drug arrest stats are twice of what they once were.
So what does that do?
It makes a city unlivable. It makes a police department where nobody can solve a crime.
And that's from Eugene Jarecki's film, The House I Live In. And I did get the impression from police talking like that, that the idea that there's been an awful lot of activity in arrests and convictions and drug-related crime, but it hasn't gone anywhere.
I found that in police car after police car. I traveled around the country with cops patrolling on their drug beats, and you know what you find over and over are cops who once upon a time felt very differently about the work they do than now that they've watched decades of it not improve public safety. They see the same people cycling through the system over and over, their addictions being left untreated, and they basically are babysitters to nonviolent addicts who they harass, embarrass, and just sort of get to know on a first-name basis. Oh, there's George again. You know, he's on the corner again. And there's a guy in the film called Magic Man, and the Providence police kept bumping into Magic Man every time we turned a corner. There he was again, being amusing, being addicted, being heartbreaking, but not being a threat to public safety. And he's diverting an incredible amount of their attention rather than serious public threats, which we know we have, and cops are distracted from dealing with those. And then we hear absurd politicians who should be run out of office saying that we should put more guns in schools and arm teachers and have armed guards at school doors. I don't know, public figure, why don't you do your homework, use some science, and try to have a mental health system in this country so that people far more early are given the kind of care that they would be given in any respectable Western democracy. We're an embarrassment, and the mental health system failure in this country affects both why we have rising violence that's going unchecked and it addresses why we have an unchecked, out-of-control drug demand problem. If we had a mental health system that had drug dealing, a drug treatment as a component of it, you would solve both problems at the same time. And, of course, nobody's yet thinking that way because it's only becoming clear to us how grave these issues are. The violence epidemic is grave, and the drug epidemic untreated is grave. And so I'm hoping that a move toward a public health system would recognize that, for example, once upon a time, when we decided to treat drugs as a crime, it was just a mistake. We've made other mistakes in history. We thought the earth was flat. It just happens to have been a wrong way to understand what Americans far more deeply understand about addiction. How many of your listeners know someone or have someone in their family who is addicted, has been hurt by addiction, has died of addiction? I lost a cousin 2 weeks ago to alcohol addiction. And so I'm watching a country punish drugs less dangerous than alcohol, more severely than alcohol. It makes no sense on its face. I would like a system that gives all of it better treatment, including alcohol. I wish my cousin had been given far more mental health analysis and help and support. And by mental health, we don't mean, is that person a crazy person? We mean, what is ailing that person? What is society doing toward that person? What is that person struggling with? And how do we as a society band together and make ourselves a stronger society? Right now, we're allowing ourselves to become a society run by the rich at the expense of everybody else. America, the top richest 400 people now have more money than the bottom 150 million people. That's not a democracy. That's not the America that's sung about in the house I live in. That's a country that's given up on the idea of hope and redemption for a mass population within itself.
This film first came out about a little over a year ago. During that time, what sort of reaction have you seen, and has it gone just beyond the usual areas where you would expect to find a sympathetic response?
Yeah, I mean, we show the film in all quarters of the country. I've been in 45 states with it this year. I've been in prisons, churches, schools, professional conferences of prosecutors and cops and dealers and DEA officers. And the reality is, what you get is a very strong response because people feel the film is respectful of the world they know very, very well. So even though people you would think would be sort of antagonistic to it if they work inside the system because it critiques the system, well, they themselves have criticisms of the system. And if I can share some of the ones that people are talking about in a respectful way, they actually feel that their life's work has been, you know, respected for its pros and cons. I mean, I'm not a person making a film saying drugs are not a problem. What are these cops busy doing here? I'm saying drugs are a serious problem. Why have these cops been put in a role which is a recipe for failure? Couldn't they be helping grandmothers across the street and solving real crimes like rape, robbery, and murder? And can't we let medically oriented professionals deal with the problem of addiction, which is a medically oriented problem? It's a very rational argument, and I think they are welcoming that because we've wasted $1 trillion. We've gotten nowhere. We're the laughingstock of the world, and we have the largest prison population of any country in the world. This beacon of democracy is the world's leading jailer. Everyone inside the system knows that, and they know there's something wrong with that.
And coming up from here, well, first of all, I did want to ask you. You said you've gotten a sympathetic response in all quarters.
Yeah.
Here, of course, we're on public radio. I think you're going to get a certain audience with a certain type of response. Have you been able to go on, say, conservative political talk
sure.
radio shows
sure.
and get a fair hearing?
Yeah, this is not a liberal conservative issue. I mean, to be blunt with you, some of the leading lights in the country right now on crying out for reform of the drug war are conservatives. Grover Norquist, enemy of the drug war. Chris Christie, enemy of the drug war. George Shultz, James Baker, Pat Robertson recently critiqued the drug war and these guys are doing it because for a lot of reasons. They see it as a bloated federal program that's been a total failure, and Grover Norquist doesn't want to see taxpayer money of $1 trillion being spent on a total loser that doesn't advance the country. And so this isn't a question of owned by one party or another. And I have to say, the problem of the drug war was created by both parties quite equally. I mean, one of the biggest explosions in the drug war, of course, was Tip O'Neill's support for the incredible severity of crack laws. And Tip O'Neill did that because of the death of basketball player Len Bias, who was drafted by the Celtics and then died prior to his career getting to take off. And it was said, oh, he was a crack user. And that spread like wildfire, led to the passage of incredibly strict crack laws that punished crack 100 times more severely than powder, to the incredible detriment of those who were arrested for it, who were predominantly black. So we went on with life. It was only sometime later that quietly the news came out, oh, by the way, Len Bias never used crack. So it was all based on hyperbole, all propaganda, and Tip O'Neill and fellow Democrats like Joe Biden and Bill Clinton and others really ratcheted up incredible severity in the drug laws as much as anybody else. So when I talk to audiences of conservatives, in many ways they look at the drug war as something in many ways bolstered by the Democrats as much or more than anyone else. So each party has its role to play in this, and I think you find there's a new voice, a new chorus of unity on reforming it, because those on the right who are upset about the money it's wasting have common cause with those on the left who may be more concerned with its human rights implications.
Well, we've been talking today on Focus with Eugene Jarecki about his documentary film, The House I Live In, about the U.S. war on drugs. Eugene, thank you very much for being with us on the program today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Jim Meadows, and you've been listening to an encore presentation of Focus on WILL. Tune in for conversations about issues and ideas that affect your life each weekday morning at 10, with a replay at 8 p.m. We welcome any additional comments or questions you have about today's show on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. You can always find free downloadable podcasts of the show on our website, and you can also find Focus on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. That's Focus numbers 580. This is Focus on WILL AM 580.